For those that just joined us, welcome, and the others welcome again, obviously. I'm gonna do a few things, look at where we're coming from, try to confuse you, as it confuses me if you look at what's happening in the world, because there's lots of trends that actually are taking place and will take place the coming years. But it's of course one of the trends that we worry about most at the moment is something we can't influence, because we're in the hands of politicians. Does not feel good, but anyhow. Although in our business we're sort of used to it, because we always depend on legislation. And then I'll try to paint a picture on how we think we can make use of those trends and why our business actually can benefit from the trends that we see happening globally. So the structure is very simple. So everything I say is not true, and you can't hold it against me, obviously, which is also not true. This is where we're coming from. And I'm going to give away a secret already. We have changed our strategy. I've always been interested in cars and stuff, and there was a famous car journalist that said, if they change one bolt on an Astra, an Opel Astra or a Volkswagen, that's bigger news than a whole new Rolls Royce for the world. Well, we sort of have the same strategy, because the change in our strategy is something that you might see at the end. It happens here. We changed this sign. I'll get to that. I at least got your attention. Thank you. 10 years ago we promised you we would be consistent in strategy, and I think we've been consistent. So that's why a change is a big thing, and even if this is a very small change. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to look at the progress, as I said, trends, building blocks, and how we can make use of the changes that are occurring in the world. Let's start at the right-hand side, at the bottom, because that's for sure something that keeps us busy, reaching 5-6%. We promised 5-6% EBITDA through the cycle. As I just indicated, the only change in the strategy is this sign in front of the 10% for professionals. So we do. We are confident that actually we will get to the 5-6% again. In a normal market, normal cycle. Robert John is going to come back to that in a lot more detail than I will. But we will reconfirm the fact. But obviously, it says areas for improvement. We're not there. And the progress last year to this year has been relatively slow, mainly caused by the fact that, of course, the cycle has developed differently than it usually would. Usually we would now have booming perm business, booming professionals business in basically all markets. And that obviously would have a big impact on our bottom line. So that's why we're not there yet. But we'll get there. And Robert John is going to come back to that in a lot more detail. Obviously, the top one, macroeconomics, nothing we can do about it. So we don't worry about it. We only prepare ourselves for every possible event, as always. As you might remember, in 07, we prepared ourselves for a downturn. We were sort of naive, because the downturn we prepared ourselves for was... really, it was a kindergarten compared to what actually happened. But still, we prepared ourselves. It helped. The ACC Work Directive, of course, a very important piece of legislation that has to be implemented 4 days from now all across Europe and every country. Well, guess what? They're not there yet. And, of course, this is potentially a big business, a big segment of the markets that are today closed, or only for a limited part accessible for us. So that's why it is extremely important. We put a lot of pressure there. It's also important, that's why we have Anne-Marie Munz, that later today is going to explain exactly what the opportunities are, what still needs to be done, and since it's not in legislation in all countries, what we will do to actually make sure as an industry that the directive is being followed by the respective countries. We have not been consistent in gaining market share in every market and every segment. By definition, we know, of course, this will always be the case, because you will not gain market share always everywhere. But it is for sure one of our very important parts of our strategy. So we push more and more. But again, we're honest, we're open, it doesn't happen everywhere. If you look at what has happened, actually quite a few things have also happened. It also looks better if the list is longer, right? Hope you appreciate that. Overall, if you look at it, what we've done, we've had a strong performance in spite of quite a few things happening around us. The vision, of course, is again, we are building a company. If you build a company and you merge two big ones, just to make sure that we agree on the vision here, at least that we are clear on the vision here, then you, of course, you change both companies. Because the merger between Vero and Randstad, they were both that big that not one is prevailing. In one area, one will be bigger, etc., etc. But the vision has stayed the same, obviously. But you have to think in a process on how to get where you want to go to. It's very simple. The DNA of our company is field steering. That means if we want to build one company, we have to make sure that everybody in the company, whatever they do, uses field steering. What you see happening, of course, in a merger is that that sort of specific DNA from one company takes time to migrate to the other company. And then if on top of that you have the biggest crisis ever, focus might change a bit. So what we have been doing this year particularly, actually last year I should actually start with, we had what we call the reconnecting program, we told you about it. So we cascaded down what we are, what our values are, how we function, what are the do's and don'ts, the history, and how do we operate. We went through every company, every level, everybody in the company was included in this program. Of course, what happens, we have 20-25% turnover at the lowest level in the organization mainly, consultants. Because turnover at branch management level is about 5, and above that is about 0, unless we stimulate people to leave. As you have read again in the press release this morning, sometimes we unfortunately have to do that. You also have to, of course, make sure that everybody joining the company gets the same DNA injected as from day one. So that's why this year, focus everywhere has been, every company must have an onboard training, which was not the case yet in all companies. And two, every company must have field steering. Obviously, next step is that we're going to have the next levels train again to work with the dashboard, play the games you played, hopefully better than most, but they have more time and more support. So that's how we are building one company, so that we have the same KPIs. I mean, we might use different ones in different situations, that we have the same way of management, that we talk the same language, etc., etc. So we're well on the way, I think. I think that's one of the biggest achievements so far, to be honest. Client profitability, we are more and more focusing on whether or not it makes sense to serve as a customer. We're getting close to Christmas, so I'm looking forward to all the letters from the clients thanking me for supporting them where we made a loss. Disappointingly enough, I never get these letters. I only get requests for lower prices. So we decided to stop giving away presents. So we are more and more critical on client profitability. That sometimes might have an impact on top line, but it'll improve bottom line, obviously. Professionals, organic growth, where possible. Areas like France, Belgium, Germany, US, and quite a few more. We've seen high organic growth. Excellent performances. And other areas like Holland, for example, UK, disappointing. We can always blame it on market, but obviously it's our choice. We were obviously in the segments where market wasn't there, so we need to refocus faster. That's our mistake and our choice. But overall, good organic growth in quite a few markets. On top of that, we put the growth accelerator in place. I'll get back to that in more detail later. We acquired Firion, which actually changed quite a lot in the ranking if you look at the professionals business worldwide. The other thing we bet on, of course, as from the moment that we, acquired a video was big international clients want to have less suppliers in more countries in more segments. I'll get back to the development of that. In spite of, again, quite a sizable acquisition. Our financial position is solid. We've again developed quite a few new delivery models. And when I explain to you what trends we see happening in the world, I'll get back to those as we go along. We've had a lot of debate on this slide, so please don't look at the absolute numbers, because there are many different sorts of definitions you could apply to what actually is the total market. But anyhow, what is clear is that if you look at the countries here, those are the countries that matter, because that's where the profit can be made, potentially. And in our case, actually, in quite a few. You also see that the market share, if you take a wider definition of market, is still fairly low in lots of these geographies. That, of course, has led to our conclusion, the conclusion we've had for many years now, that you should focus on a limited number of markets. We're not going to go to new countries. It's not our focus. I mean, in time, we might have one or two exceptions. But anyhow, in general, we won't, because we're happy where we are, and we want to have a lot more market share where we are today. Hence, we decided to buy SFN, of course, which was one of the reasons, as has been explained by Greg yesterday. So no new markets. We're in top three in quite a few markets, but being in top three still means quite often that there's still a lot of markets that we are not in, markets we are not in, and segments we are not in, so still lots of potentials to copy-paste what we know works in those segments. And of course, India, China, and Brazil are big on our radar screen. I told a few of you, if you look at our biggest market today in hours invoiced, that's India. More than 10% of the total number of hours we invoice happens in India. Our market is, as any market, price times quantity. Quantity is high, but price is still pretty low. That's why it's still less than 2% of revenue. But obviously, with 8 to 15% wage inflation, 10 years from now, our successors will be grateful, because that are going to be very important markets. Same goes for China, of course. Developing very fast, although we do take a different focus there than a few of our main competitors. We started the business by acquiring a payroll business. Payroll in China is fairly complicated, because first of all, you need to have permits, a zillion permits if you want to cover all of China. Two, you have different regulations. So it's a very, very IT-intensive activity. It's very, very low margins, and it requires huge investments in IT. That's why our strategy is on search and selection, permanent placement, and staffing, which is growing fast. Because we do payroll 60,000, 50,000 people in China. We don't count them, because this is really, we count only the margin, as we explained to you. We changed that about, I think, 2 years ago now. But anyhow, so we're well positioned in those markets. And explained to also to quite a few, if you look at the BRIC countries, that we research Russia. It's still a relatively small market. The environment in which you have to function is not stable or is difficult to forecast, so we decided not to go there. Markets. If you look at the global, I think this is an interesting picture, by the way. If you look at what happened in our markets, then you see that we have a big gap between the top three. And to be honest, I mean, there's a lot of discussion whether you're one, two, or three. Doesn't really matter. You have to be big in specific markets. That's what matters, because that drives profitability. The top three and then the rest of the market. There's huge gaps. This, of course, is a standard business case. In a situation like this, you have to have superior organic growth. And one of your core competences has to be mergers and acquisitions. When we can afford it, we will buy in existing markets. We will try to have a bigger and bigger part in professionals. And again, density or market share equals profitability. So that means that should drive profitability. If then other markets develop where we are not present, we'll be too late and we'll buy them. That's the strategy we followed as from 2002, and we won't change that. If you look at the professionals market, things have also changed. Here we rank the companies based on gross margin more than on revenues, because, for example, permanent placements plays a role there. With the acquisition of SFN, we are now number 2. But you can also see that the gap is a lot smaller between companies. We also know that the professionals market, if you look at our big clients, for example, have a far more fragmented suppliers base than in staffing. Many multinationals today have 2-3 staffing companies globally as suppliers. Well, they probably have maybe even 2,000 or 3,000 companies supplying them in the professionals field. This, of course, is a trend that is an opportunity that is fantastic because it's huge. And we're going to see the same processes we have seen, the same development we have seen in staffing. It's inevitable. You'll see less suppliers. Per OPCO, you see a more, if you want, process-driven supply, which, of course, to the extreme has happened in the U.S. to a large extent already through VMS and MSPs. I'll get to that. It's going to happen in all markets. And big part of the market still can be influenced on how they do this. So we're also developing new delivery concepts, sets for professionals. I'll get back to that. Or actually have delivered. Yesterday, a question on the professional segment, obviously, biggest one being IT, second biggest finance, then engineering and healthcare. If you look at what's happening, of course, I mean, this is all obvious, but still, it helps us to sort out, if you want, our thinking. I mean, globalization, volatility, demographics, sectoral shifts, work-life balance, etc. All these elements lead to change in behavior. It also leads to different market situations. We had every 6-7 years we have a respectable company do research on the effect of staffing, which is extremely important for us to understand what's happening, but it also helps us in explaining to politicians, lawmakers, unions, and what have you, what the positive effect of our business is. Conclusion is clear. Every time somebody does his research, we had McKinsey do it, we had Bain do it, we had now BCG doing it, the conclusion is always the same, that we create as an industry a lot of jobs. 12 million people work through companies like ours, and we created about 900,000 jobs in Europe and 400,000 in the U.S. as an industry, which is huge. That means those jobs would not have been there, would companies like ours not have been in existence. Or there would have been other solutions, and I'll get back to that in a minute, because some unions are a bit more aggressive towards staffing. That means the market will find other solutions. And so will we, by the way. Sorry, you got big on this one, of course. The globalization is clear because that drives companies to the need to be more efficient. I always explain, we sell two things. We sell two things. And also internally, we sometimes have to explain this. It's on a scale, and it is on one side of the scale is highest return on every euro, dollar, or whatever you invest in labor. That's what we do. So we have the most efficient capacity for companies. And on the other end of the scale is know-how. And know-how is obviously not our know-how, but the know-how of the people we put to work. So the more specialized engineers, IT, whatever you have, the know-how part is more important. And the lower in the salary scale or competency scale, blue collar, efficiency is more important. And what we supply companies is always somewhere in the middle. And this is applicable not only to the people working, but also managing the people that work and the numbers that work. So in that respect, as I often said, it's more outsourcing something that's not the core competence of a company to us than something else. That is the most important reason of big growth, obviously. We make companies and organizations more efficient, and we fill the needs of flex workers. I'll get back to that. Demographics is going to play a big role. Obviously, a potential recession, like we might be facing now, of course, has an effect over time, but strategically doesn't change the picture. I'll get back to that, too, in a minute. If you look where the big growth is in labor force, it's obviously not in the EU nor in Japan. I think the staggering statistic, which I quoted more often, is in Japan there are now about 120 million people living. By 2050, I think there will only be 67 million people left. There's quite a lot of things happening. In Europe, we're going to be short of 32 million people working, quantity. If you look at the quality, we're now doing the research to actually try and get a number there. With the increasing demands for every job, and still a big part of the population with a low level of education, the mismatch is even going to be bigger. This means job security, obviously. This means more mobility, because if people know they're going to get a job anyhow, they'll move. Big growths are, of course, India, still in China, South America. The countries are listed here. So you see here the growth in population, the growth in the labor force, and world population and world labor force. This helps us to focus. It's just one of those trends that we look at. For these sort of strategic elements, you have to have a long-term view, obviously. Because again, as I said, India is big in numbers of hours, low in revenue, decent in profit, but still a decent profit on a low revenue still has a very, very limited impact on our total results. But still, we know that over time, we have to position the company to actually benefit from these sort of trends. Here we listed a number of those trends and the effects on the labor market. We see mismatches everywhere, obviously. Again, we see top left side competences. So we see shortages in specific jobs, profiles, and we see too much supply in others, which translates in relatively high unemployment of low-skilled people. By the way, potentially social problems, etc., which I think society and politicians should take care of, because that's an extremely dangerous development, but still, not now and here. U.S. will need 25 million extra workers by 2030 to sustain economic growth, just to look at the number. 25% of Indian and 20% of Russian professionals currently considered employable by multinationals. So there's a big pool of potential supply, but maybe in a different place than where the work is. Although, by the way, ratio people moving to work or work moving to people is 1 to 100. But still, if we can have 10% of that 1 to 100, that's still a big business. 45 million new entrants in global job market annually. If you look at the youth unemployment today, by the way, that also, again, is a development that needs to be fixed. And as I said, 35 million extra workers needed in Europe by 2050. Obviously, it doesn't happen on the 31st of December 2049. It's a gradual development, and it's going to have a big effect with the baby boomers, of course, retiring the next 5 years. And again, the crisis has an effect, the potential crisis, delays, the effects of what's happening here. But already today what we see happening is professionals from, for example, Spain, moving to Northern Europe to work, which in the past never happened. Which most people can understand if you live in Spain. Yeah, why move to Belfast? Yeah. This is maybe obvious, but still very important. We, of course, have to position our service offering on both sides of our market, on the supply and on the demand side. I think there's no big surprises here. So I don't want to get into this. I think this is always but important. Yeah. The opportunities created by the mismatch, obviously, that's what we try to focus on. We look at what industries are growing, we look at geographies, where there is supply and demand differences, and we try to bridge those. And for a few segments, we develop new delivery models. One delivery model, by the way, that we already have, but is concentrated in only a few countries, is outsourcing. What you see happening historically, the moment that staffing gets more barriers or becomes very expensive, the market finds new solutions. Almost in all cases, the solution they look for is a form of outsourcing. Today, in our revenue mix, we have 480 million euros revenue in outsourcing. The biggest chunk of that is in Japan, which is an excellent example of what I just said, because in Japan, obviously, until fairly recently, staffing in industrial activities was not allowed. The market found another solution, outsourcing. The potential downside of outsourcing, obviously, is that for unions, for example, they can't negotiate because it's a very fragmented market. There's a big variety of players. That means the social security of the people working in that activity is less protected than it would be in, for example, our activity. That's what we try to explain to unions, that they can come in this nice building, have a cup of coffee, negotiate about the collective labor agreement. If our life is too difficult, the market will find other solutions. They will have to. In Japan, there was no option. Because in Japan, because of the culture of lifetime employment, the people that have worked for a company too long, or very long, are extremely expensive. The effect of that has been creation of outsourcing and the fact that flex workers get paid less than 50% of these lifetime employees, which is a huge mismatch. But if you are a politician in Japan and you want to fix this short term and don't change the culture, more factories will move to China inevitably. So it's a very delicate balance. So we try to reason with unions, for example, and politicians to explain to them that they're potentially playing with fire. And it's a very complicated process to change this. But anyhow, outsourcing is a delivery model. Again, we have 480 million revenue there with very decent returns. It's something we will look for to expand in specific markets. And of course, the main issue there is low risk. Because potentially, outsourcing means you get paid per unit. So we have to be sure that we can manage that. If you look at international clients, our slide only goes back to 2009, where it was 21%, and of course then in between we had, during that we had a crisis, and in spite of that, the part of our revenue generated by international contracts has grown to 24%. The dip here is caused by Spherion, obviously. I could be very Dutch and say that US clients are international, but it's not how we look at it. We're a global company, obviously. They have national contracts, so that's why 2 billion of sales distorted the picture a bit. It'll go up even more, obviously. If we go back until 2005, if I remember well by heart, I think we were at 12 or 13%. So if you look at the relative increase and the absolute increase, it's huge. Really huge. And new developments and solutions in the markets have actually amplified that effect even more. Like MSPs globally, etc., etc. Well, if you also look at number of international tenders, this is year to date. Again, we're going to have a considerably higher amount of international tenders again this year than last year. This, by the way, is also competence you have to master. Obviously, we monitor the number of successes we have. First of all, we decide which ones to actually put an effort in and which ones to ignore or reject, because if you don't know the client, if you don't know anything, we have no relationship. The cheapest price is going to win. That's not what we're going to do. But anyhow, a very important competence which we have centralized in a few places in the world to make sure that we score well there. And actually our success is, percentage has gone up. We have a global client solutions team. They changed the name from International Account Management. I found the last name easier than the new one, but the new one describes better what they do, so... which is here in Amsterdam, and then we have, of course, people all around the globe that are part of this team to make sure that we service them. And we have split them in industry, has been explained to you in one of our former investor relations day, but just to explain what's happening. If you look at managed services, of course, a big development in the U.S. And as we have confessed to you in the past, at the start of this development, we were too late. And we, at that point in time, we're both Randstad and Video. but also because we were only in staffing and there was less of a topic. Video for reasons of profitability, what have you. Maybe a fragmented approach because of all the different units not working as one. So we had to do, we had some catching up to do, which I think we did. Because again, the big market is the US here, and we see that a number of multinationals want to have it global. The actual number of global implementations of VMS systems and MSPs is very, very limited. Because if you want to do it everywhere, it's very complicated. Very complicated. The return on investment is not there. Because you also would have to do it in very small markets, actually, at least that's what some companies insist on doing. So it doesn't happen. But still, we doubled our size in the MSP world. Leadership, market leadership in RPO, so the outsourcing of HR processes, which actually helps us. So the additional 1.7 billion spent we have across 70 programs in the US helps us. We take a specific view at MSP. MSP for us is not a profit center. I didn't find any profit centers yet, at nobody, by the way, yet. Nobody makes money on this. MSP, for us, is only attractive if we know that we can direct a reasonable part of the spend to our own opcos. That's the intent. So it's sales costs, if you want. And if they are at break-even, fantastic. That's nice. If it's a big international MSP with a very complicated implementation, with a limited accessibility for our opcos to supply, we're not interested. Somebody else can be the MSP, and we have developed delivery models to supply to MSPs in a very efficient way that still enables us to make a profit without having to do the MSP. So we make clear choices there. Oh, by the way, maybe here the other thing we are developing is in-house services for professionals. Well, I'll get back to that in a minute. The European directive. There have been some successes, and again, Annemarie is going to come back to that in more detail, but by far not enough. There are still a lot of limits for us to operate. For example, public sector in Belgium. In Belgium, there are 1.1 million civil servants. On a population of 10 million, that's a sizable market. If you then would apply the same penetration rates, obviously not next year, but let's say 5-10 years from now, it's a huge addition to our market. And this is only Belgium. France has opened up, but obviously development it always develops very, very slow and then accelerates. If you would apply the same penetration rate to the civil servants in France compared to what we now see in the clerical market, it's huge. If you look at the bans we have in a certain number of countries with reasons for staffing, with periods of time that we're allowed to work, with renewals of contracts, it's huge. So this for sure is a very important piece of work we have to solve as an industry. Most of it is being done through our international branch organization called SIET, of which Fred van Aasteren is the president, and Annemarie is the president of EuroSIET. So we try to make sure that we can help to make this happen. There are reasons and there's a reward for countries actually to have a more efficient labor market, which is obvious. So this is the research that has been done. If you have an efficient market, economy does better. We have two illustrations there, this one and this one. If you look at competitiveness of countries related to flexibility in the labor market, there's a very clear correlation. It helps to explain to politicians that and unions that it might look frightening, but it helps. It creates jobs. Penetration rates. Except for the US, each cycle penetration rates increased. Now we see the US also changing, as we have discussed yesterday. The other thing, of course, is that penetration rates is one measure of the market. The other one is, of course, the fact that in professionals, penetration rates are growing a lot faster than the average. That means the total number of people, so the quantity influence is smaller than the price effect on a total market. As was illustrated by Greg's development, but almost half the market now is professionals, and that's going to happen everywhere, inevitably. It's also true because in a number of developing markets, by the way, we are not active in blue collar. In China, where a factory worker might make, it used to be 50 euro cents, maybe now they make 70 euro cents an hour. There's no way you can have a model that makes money. So we only look there at the professionals part of the market, as in India, as in Singapore, etc., etc. So in all new markets, we only focus on at least the upper part of the middle jobs, and then the higher part. And again, these also have to go up because of the fact that, based on the directive, closed markets have to open. Will have a huge effect. If you look at the building blocks, of course, our strategy, as you have seen, I think I explained most of these things. People development is extremely important, obviously. So as most of you know, we have this rule that 80% of the management positions, 8-0, have to be fulfilled from within. The last 4 years we've been able to do that, and we'll continue to do that. It is the best way and the most reliable way to build a good company. Every year we measure the engagement score of our employees. It has to be at least 7.5. It's considerably higher and has been going up again for the last 3 years, which is excellent. There's a few things I'm going to come back on. All our segments. Start with staffing. Market share growth, obviously, client profitability plays a bigger role here. Because per market we do see that there are clients that actually underpay what we need. We're still following the old strategy, if you want, but still very effective, to move large clients to in-house. Client get a better service, we get a bigger market share. And in the branches, there's capacity left to actually develop the segments of the market they should be developing. So that's either new clients that in the future can be transferred to in-house, or more clerical, more specialized, more SME. Permanent placement is becoming more and more important, obviously. Because of the demographic developments, again, mobility on the labor market is going to increase. You could also blame it on Generation Y and what have you, but anyhow. For sure, what's going to happen is we're going to have more mobility on the labor market. People with competences will change more easily, more often between jobs. When there is movement between jobs, mobility on the labor market, we can be in between. So that's why we are putting a lot of effort in perm placement. I'm going to come back on that in a minute. Productivity improvements and work processes. So we constantly, as I said, develop new delivery models. For example, to deliver to MSPs. We now have a solution called Randstad Direct, which we use in agriculture environment. Here in Holland, for example, it's a big market, which is very, very cost effective, growing very fast. So for every separate segment, we see more and more segmentation needed to supply to those markets. And we think we so far have been pretty successful in developing new models. And EBITDA margin target stays at 5 to 7%. Which we think is fair. Oops, I forgot one. More specialties. I'm not going to talk long about it because it is obvious. Specialty is what we define as, we have the same process as in staffing, but you need specialty knowledge about that segment or job, and you need a tailored marketing for that specific group. It in general should generate more growth and above average productivity per FTE. So not necessarily gross margin, but productivity, gross profit per FTE. An example is call centers, obviously. Call centers, the average gross margin is not so high, but if you organize it well, you can have very high productivity. So that means the gross profit per FTE will be high. It's a bit like in-house services. We are more and more driving to specialties in quite a few markets. Jacques yesterday showed you the curve that we look at in developing our country. It starts with a basic standardized concept, delivery model. The next step is more specialties, inevitably. So per market, of course, we follow this development line. And of course, developments are going faster and faster. So that's what we're doing. We have a few examples here, call centers, logistical companies, finance, we started in quite a few of our staffing companies, cross-border staffing, healthcare, for example, of course, there's big shortages in quite a few countries. We nowadays, we recruit nurses in Portugal and put them to work in Belgium, as an example. So we have a cross-border staffing organization that facilitates all these international movements. Historically, it has been getting people from Poland and put them to work in the UK or Holland. But we have widened that scope and we see a lot more mobility between many, many different countries for different jobs. Engineers to the Middle East, etc., etc. Lots of examples. It's an activity that will have to get a lot bigger. In-house services has been very successful. Target was 4-5% EBITDA. As you have seen, we are hitting that target at about 4.7%. It also says something about the cycle, obviously, that professionals hardly makes more profit than in-house. That's an unusual situation. But it works. This concept has also been developed. We nowadays take care of the planning of permanent staff at the total facility of the client. We make analysis of jobs, exactly what competences are needed. How can we promote internal mobility within an organization? Because if you're qualified for one machine and you're not for the other, by definition your organization is less efficient, etc., etc. So we do a lot of extra things there to keep on developing this concept and to keep the advantage we have on competition. And if you look at the growth rates and the revenue, I think we could say that we are successful in doing that. So there still, we also maintain the target of 4-5% EBITDA. Professionals. We started with learning, as you might know, because we were small in professionals. Video was big. So we spent a year and making sure that we determined what actually were the best practices and how a concept should look like. Then we tested it. And then we started to multiply it, do it faster and more. That works. Permanent placement, again, very volatile, but also, of course, very profitable in the good years. And some markets are doing very well, other markets are more depressed. Volatility, an example, is the city in London, obviously. Business disappeared completely. Then there was a strange short blip up. We saw many investment funds that have you start up in the city, and now market is depressed again. But still, an important part of the business, France growing very fast, many, many countries where we invest a lot in permanent placement because it has to become a bigger part of our business. I explained earlier why. We have been rebranding our professional businesses, the last one being our professional business in the US last month. Preparing the world for more, obviously. And the change is that we said it should be at about 10%, not above. We included healthcare in this part of the business, which is a lower profit business. And if you look at the total mix, in some markets, we don't think it's realistic to say we're going to be above 10%. So we say it should be at about 10%, and that's at peak margins. That also requires a significant contribution of perm, obviously. But still, should be above average. This is where we sell, and this is how much we sell. Huh? This is still excluding Sphereon, obviously. We also put in the growth accelerator. We said we want, we have the ambition to put 500 extra consultants in our professionals business on top of our organic growth that would be based on field steering. Has gone above expectations so far. We had business cases being prepared by the different opcos. They were allowed to invest the first wave of extra people. Then they have to reach the productivity thresholds again before they are allowed to invest the second wave. The example on the left, bottom side here, is Australia. We have some problems there in some other businesses, but for sure the growth accelerator has performed excellent. And we see the same in actually the initiatives we started everywhere. Going very, very well. A bit slower than we anticipated. We're now at about 180 people. We're a bit above now, we're a bit further than 6 months, but still. The original plan would have said we would be at about 200 now. But still, going very, very well, and actually the contribution is going to be better than expected. That means the cost is going to be less on balance than we anticipated it to be. Permanent placement, I just talked about that. We see growth in these markets, US, Canada, France, Holland, Germany, UK. It has to become a bigger part of a business. So in our mix, it has to become more important. But obviously, it's volatile. So in the model, we need to be able to handle the volatility. That's in our concept on how to do that. So the strange, this is a new strategy. This is the change. The rest is the same. Sound financial position, 5 to 6% through the cycle. We have to gain market share. The trends in the market, which I just gave you a bit more detail on, and the way we do it. This is a sort of a summary. Structurally, we have a growth market. It's inevitable. Well, we talk about the recovery pattern a lot. I'm going to not do this again. I told you what we are doing to build one company with the field steering, the onboard training, etc., etc. Because we have to be one company. We have the concepts and we have developed and are developing new solutions for the clients. For example, we are developing in-house for professionals. A big, big potential market. Which gives a far better solution for clients than an MSP, because an MSP is whoever sends in the resume first is going to be the champion. There's a sort of a tension between speed and quality, obviously. We know what we should do. If we can make it happen, have an in-house for professionals, it's going to be a huge addition to our portfolio. It's a huge potential market, huge potential profits, best service in the market for the clients. So concepts, we keep on developing them. And of course, we will never jeopardize the company, so we will always be careful in our financing. Robert John is going to talk a lot more about that. Thank you. I now hand over to Robert John, and we do the questions after that, I guess.
Thank you. Well, good morning. I'm going to deal with a couple of slides as well, but before doing so, this morning we've sent out a press release which summarizes the agenda items for today. It also confirms the strategy again, which Ben just summarized, and then it talks about current trading, and I'm sure you've all been able to look at it. What we indicate here is that we have seen October moving to around 5% growth, organic growth per working day, 18% including the acquisition, sorry, 19. And please note that the 5% compares to just below 7 in the month of September. And if you look at a couple of details, what is remarkable, we can see our U.S. Professionals and Canadian business growing at the speed of 18%, and the regular staffing and in-house business growing at the pace of 5%, which is slightly better than the previous month. And this kind of confirms the somewhat erratic picture that we see throughout the world. In Europe, we have seen the growth gradually reducing, again in the month of October, and especially in southern Europe, the slowdown was more pronounced compared to France and Germany, which were doing relatively better. Typically, you know, this is the industrial segment that supports the trends in those countries. We also confirm that we anticipate that our Q4 cost compared to Q3 on a like-for-like basis, so excluding the acquisition, will be like flattish, and that is roughly in line with the revenue trends that we do see. And we've also encouraged our opcos that do see the more pronounced slowdown to make the necessary adjustments right away. And I'll get back to making adjustments to our organization. But as I said, we have encouraged a couple of our opcos to react quickly, and that we expect will result in us incurring non-recurring cost of up to 20 million to realize those adjustments. So that as some comments to the press release. And I have a couple of slides that I want to discuss with you. Again, learning from cycles and managing through the cycle. And again, if you look at the current trends, you know, it's highly questionable what kind of trend we are in right now, because we do see this sort of classical recovery continuing in the United States, in North America, I should say. But as we are all a little worried about what's going to happen, I have summarized here the experiences from previous cycles and the lessons learned. So on slide 5, a small summary of how we have managed through the cycle, and these are the categories in terms of revenue. We clearly have volatility. We have seen minus 27% in 2009, and one way to deal with that is to improve the business mix geographically, but also in terms of products, and that's something which is on our agenda, and I would say the exposure to the U.S. is clearly helpful as we speak. Wages are at risk if idle time occurs. I'll get back to that, because we've managed quite nicely. If you look at 2009, we've managed ourselves quite nicely through that cycle in the context of idle time management. Operating cost items are corporate employees, the cost of that, field steering, the name of the game all the time, the effect of bonuses, I'll get back to that, and staff turnover is clearly very helpful in making adjustments to the cost base right away. Marketing, fully flexible for sure, but this is a risk as well. If we sort of don't spend enough, we might well risk the future and benefit on the short term. Accommodation, not going to get back to that one, but rental contracts at Randstad always last less than 5 years, on average 3 years, so at any point in time, we have like 1.5 years to go. If you look back at 2009, you know, it's rather easy to manage ourselves through the cycle, because we are in a position to get out of lease contracts when they expire. The other items, interest, using floating interest rates. I'm not going to elaborate on that through a specific slide, but, you know, our policy is that in good economic times, typically there is demand for money, interest rates are higher. In bad economic times, interest rates are typically lower. And that nicely sort of fits with our cash flows, because we're willing to pay more in good times and we don't want to pay more in bad times. And typically across the cycle, the floating interest rates are lower. And our calculation is that since the acquisition of VDO, we have saved roughly 120 million euros by applying this policy. Working capital, going to get back to that, but there's clearly a benefit coming out of lower sales. I mean, it's the only benefit, I think, but we have release of working capital as a result of that. So I'm going to get back to a few of those. The first one to come back to on slide 7 is the improved business mix that we have been working on. Clearly, wider geographical spread, less dependent on one region, different services in different cycles. We have been addressing that. I mean, call centers have been helpful in the downturn, especially call centers in banks, because lots of worried clients started to call banks. So the sector as a whole was down, but call centers was clearly an opportunity. Increased share of permanent placement, Ben addressed it just before. the permanent placement share in gross profit. At the early days of the combination of Randstad and Vireo, used to be between 12 and 13% of gross profit, and now it's south of 10. So still a way to go, but extremely helpful as well. Increased share of in-house services so that the regular branch, as Ben outlined, can focus on new clients. Increased share of professionals. It has a different cycle. And the acquisition of SFN, as well as the organic growth accelerator plan in this field, should be helpful. Increased exposure to human resource solutions, less cyclical and even counter-cyclical in some cases. Increased share of specialties, Ben mentioned it. It moves slightly different in the cycle. Increased public sector exposure, which was considered to be a benefit, not at this time. And please note that our public sector exposure is only relevant today in the UK and in the Netherlands. We clearly have an opportunity, and the opportunity might be reduced a little bit, but we are at the very early stages of entering into the French public sector, other South European countries. Over time, Belgium will also have to be added, and we'll clearly work on that. But for now, in the Netherlands and in the UK, it is suppressing the performance of the company. Idle time management, the other item that that I've mentioned before. What is it? It means that we have flex workers that we got to pay that we cannot charge to our clients. And this is typically the case to a limited degree, I should point out, in Germany and the Netherlands. So the key setting here is it is an issue, but of a limited degree, because it only relates to these two countries, and it can be managed. And that's what this is about. How do we manage it? Well, in Germany, we have flexibility by managing contracts. If you have a permanent contract, which is roughly applicable to half of the population, you have a 6 months probation period. And typically people aim at getting to a permanent position and a client. So there's a lot of sort of flow in these in this segment of people, but especially the probation period is extremely helpful. The other half is on a temp contract. And terminating the temp contract just before Christmas is a major help to avoiding idle time during Christmas, for example. And then a key component is time accounts. We do have people that typically work overtime, and they don't tend to have a 40-hour contract per week, but less. And then they make overtime, we don't pay it. We put it in a time account. And whenever idle time occurs, it's netted out. And this you can typically do up to 200 hours per employee, and it has proven to be an extremely effective tool in 2009, because the impact of idle time in our books has been immaterial. In Germany, it has been minimal. At group level, it has been immaterial. In the Netherlands, we also have some idle time. Risks, roughly 80% of the total population is fully flexible of the flex workers. 20% has a temp contract, so a contract for a defined period of time. Again, providing flexibility, and it's typically the people that we place first. At the profession, in the professionals business, we do have some permanent contracts as well, and that's where it gets much more difficult, especially when you've been in a decline for like 2 to 3 years. You're kind of running through your flexibility, and then it becomes much more complicated, and that's where we have seen impact from idle time. But on the larger scale of things, it is relatively limited, and again at group level, immaterial. Another point to adjust our cost base is field steering. Slide 9. I'm going to go quickly through this, but these are the old days in 2000, and these were the days in 2008 and 9. And what is relevant is that if revenues go down, we should see our FTE and our outlook and our outlets go down as well. Well, here wrong, here right. This is the US. If you look at Germany, wrong over here, right over here. A lot of alignment, and this is steered by field steering to quite some degree. So you clearly can see the effect of preparations here. Field steering helps us in the upturn, in the downturn, but also if the developments are like flat. Then if you look at the OPEX management of the company, these are the annual levels of our operating expenses 2007, 2008, and 2009. A reduction of 22%. And almost 75% of our operating expenses is related to people, salaries, and bonuses, etc. The cost base is highly flexible, and it's steered by field steering again. And 75% of our cost savings in 2009 was realized without provisions. And that is because we have continued, and I'm going to flip through that quickly, we have continued, on slide 12, natural attrition. The blue line over here in the Netherlands is growth, and the orange line is turnover of staff. In the U.S., the blue line is growth, the orange line is staff turnover. In Germany, staff turnover. And as you can see, we have seen significant continued staff turnover, most of that natural, by far most of that. And that is because our people in the field, and to some degree but less in the back office, are typically young people, especially in the field. They are young, they have their first or second job, they're well educated, like bachelor or master level. And typically in a labor market, these people tend to be sort of fluid. And their salaries on West European standards are between 2,000 and 2,500 euros a month. And these people continue to find jobs. And that's why we see continued staff turnover also in very difficult times. The back office is more challenging, and that's typically where we see the provisions in order to deal with it. So that means that a key way to adjust our cost base is to take our foot from the accelerator. When we have people leaving, we shouldn't replace them. That is the key way to save cost at Randstad. And next to that, of course, we have bonuses, and that's also extremely helpful to adjust the cost base. The effect of that is hard to estimate, because if you reset your targets for the next year, you typically have lower targets, so bonuses are a little easier to earn. But I would say that we have taken out at least 100 million of the cost base because of reduced bonuses in 2009. The breakdown of the annualized cost savings here, so 800 million of costs were taken out. Please remember that the synergies of Vedior were 100 million. It was a substantial amount, but it was only 100 million in the context of these 800 million. As you can see, the blue part, 600 out of that was managed organically through the cycle. Effectively, synergies was 100 million and restructuring was another 100 million. So this is how we look back at a scenario of minus 27% in 2009. And our cost base moved from 700 million high point per quarter in 2008 to 500 million in Q3 2009. Then some remarks about marketing. As I said, almost fully flexible. And this is the percentage of revenues. So this is our revenue development on the scale over here. And this is our marketing cost development. And it moved from almost 1% to 0.8% of revenues. And we're rather sort of open with you. We feel it might be a too easy escape. We need the field steering to be applied thoroughly, and that is the first priority, rather than the easy escape, which is just to cut marketing expenses. And we might well, you know, have an opportunity left, right, or center, but we cannot just take the easy route here and reduce marketing expenses, because that will be a cost in the long run. And building the brand remains a key priority. The last point is important. This looks like, you know, we're spending less, yes, for sure, but there is productivity behind it, because reducing the number of brands allows us to be a lot more efficient in this field. The production cost of all the material related to marketing and branding is a much smaller proportion of the whole overall spending than it used to be before. That means the effectiveness has increased, although the relative spend has reduced. Well, some remarks about working capital. This is, by the way, release is up north here and usage is down here. So this means a positive sort of a release. And this is where you can see growth of the company. And please note that in 2008 and 2009 we have seen substantial releases of working capital, as a result of which we have seen the net debt levels decreasing. In the period 2008-09, we had an inflow of almost 300 million of working capital. I'm not looking forward to negative scenarios, but if it happens, this was clearly an underestimated item in our cash flow development and our net debt development. And if you look at the, this was sort of the cyclical part, this is the more structural part, what happens, what happened to the usage of working capital over a period of time, and it is clear, as you can see, this is the percentage of operating working capital measured over revenues, and it's clearly decreasing. And as many of you know, we do apply EVA, we just don't talk about it too often externally, but we have clearly have a light version of EVA, and it's got two components. One is every P&L of an OPCO includes a charge for operating working capital before calculating the operating profits. Technically incorrect, but operationally extremely effective. People know that we calculate operating profits after including a 10% charge over the working capital they are using, and that clearly sets a priority. And the second point is that what we do is we explain all our people that are in our education programs, in our training programs, that capital costs 1% a month. It's technically not completely correct, but it's easy to remember. And that means that when they negotiate with clients, that's what they should have in mind. By the way, we also explain them what clients are offering to pay earlier. It's not 1% discount. So we're trying to make it simple. We typically don't have these discussions of paying earlier. We always have the discussions of paying late. And we want people to be aware. And, of course, we have the specialists that go out and help them. But we want the awareness with our consultants and our management to be based on relatively simple measures. So this is how we do it. And by the way, there's another element also, that DSO is typically, days sales outstanding, is typically in the target setting of our management, and certainly of our CFOs. What is different in this cycle? What is the classical pattern? On slide 17, how does a classical pattern look like? Well, you know, we just drew a few lines. This is how we believe it should look like. We do see growth in the industrial segment exceeding any other growth and then slowing slightly because it's also building on a more challenging comparable base. The admin growth, which is the orange line here, then takes over, and then next step is that the professionals business is starting to speed up and takes over again. This is what we see in the U.S., for example. And this is what we have seen in the past. And this is roughly the reference point where we are. So this is what, from here, what we would expect to see. And the summary is relatively simple. We see it in the U.S., and we don't see it in Europe. This is the U.S. This is where we see the admin, the industrial, and the professionals developments on slide 18 going up. The blue line going down then, that's the industrial. And as you can see, admin and professionals are doing relatively well. If you look at the Netherlands and the UK, and this is where we have headwind from the public sector on slide 19, the figures of Randstad Netherlands, we do see the public sector clearly being negative and having a serious impact. In the UK, even more. In the UK, we used to have like north of 30% of public sector-related business, and that's now just around 15%, so it has decreased dramatically, and that has a major impact on the performance we see in those countries. But I would say across the board, we don't see the classical pattern in Europe because growth rates are slowing too quickly. The perm business, again, Ben referred to it, the green line here is the perm market development, and the blue line is the general staffing development in that market. And it's clear that the volatility in perm is higher, but it follows a similar pattern. And this is when you look at it indexed, and I think a key point to make here is we haven't even returned to this level, so still a way to go. And that also gels with the point I made that at Randstad we do see roughly between 9 and 10% of gross profit being related to permanent placement fees, which used to be between 12 and 13 in the good old days. So we still have a way to go, a long recovery path to the 07 levels. So the key messages here are that the U.S. shows a classical pattern with promising growth in all segments across the board. And again, note please that the month of October is even slightly better than the month of September in the staffing and in-house segment. We clearly see differences among European countries. The public sector is a pain in these two countries, and the recovery in perm seems identical, but we still have a way to go here. Now, how do we manage on actuals? This slide we have used in the past. I mean, with everything in mind that I've just shared with you, you know, if we are in a growth phase like 23, then, you know, like in any other phase, market share gains. That remains the name of the game in our company. Productivity management through unit steering, that continues to be a priority. And you've all experienced how that works out well. If we grow, we are also adding the incremental conversion ratio, because the point of field steering is that we make sure the system is rolled out everywhere. All our people get signals out of unit steering, and the real challenge is that they do something with it on time. And one way to sort of support that is to put a little pressure from the top by setting an ambition in terms of the incremental conversion ratio. So if we earn in a positive scenario new gross profit, we want to see at least 50% of that converted into EBITDA. And there might be exceptions, but at least we want to be able to discuss that with our management. We might allow them to be at 40 or lower because we sort of invest additional in growth opportunities. But as a rule of thumb, that's what we're looking for. In a downturn scenario, we have the recovery ratio. And effectively, it works the same, but the other way around. If we lose gross profit, we want at least 50% to be recovered through cost reductions. And it's, you know, this is not rocket science, I realize that, but it's the pressure we put on our opcos where field steering leads the way to ensure that we do see people acting on the back of the information they have on their plate. And I would say again, in 2009, we have seen a pretty good performance in the context of the recovery ratio. Now, there are, we've been thinking about how to get back to this 5 and 6%, and just to make sure that you don't think we've been using dope, we have been looking at the various scenarios here. If we would see flat revenue development, because as Ben outlined, we have no clue what will happen next year, and it's our role to be able to be prepared and to adapt to any possible trend. If the trend would be flat revenues, then it means that the classical patterns are flattening. We do see necessities of improving the business mix constantly, but we will also drive productivity gains. And we believe that if we have flat revenues, we have opportunities to drive the EBITDA margin up in 2012 if we would see flat revenues. So that would help us to go up. Then, if we do continue to see revenue growth, which would be the normal pattern, I mean, we are kind of entitled to continued growth, aren't we? Having seen like two downturns already in 10 years, we cannot handle a third one, let's say psychologically. But if we continue to see the normal patterns continuing, then, you know, the 5 to 6% is clearly in reach. If you add two more years of substantial growth, there's no doubt in our mind that we will get to the 5 to 6% range. And that, again, would be a normal pattern. But we're not living in normal times. So if we get into a negative scenario, a decline scenario, then we'll focus on profit protection, clearly. And we already made that point. We will make the adjustments whenever necessary. We allow our companies to, if they can't handle it through the natural attrition, to make reorganizations, to adjust the organization. We'll take the provisions for that. And the key rule that we will apply is you've got to earn it back within 12 months. And by the way, in our banking documents, we have clearly excluded the cost of reorganizations from the calculations of the leverage ratio. So that is clearly an interest of all the financiers of Randstad and ourselves to be able to make any adjustments necessary, and that has been translated into the right language, as we did in 2008 and 2009. So this is what we believe justifies the ambition of the company. And one element in that is that we've been expanding our branches, not in terms of square meters, but by occupation. We love branches where we have more people rather than small branches, because it allows us to sort of use the natural attrition and to reduce the number of people but still remain active on that location. And since some years ago, we've seen roughly the number of field FTE improving from here to here, with kind of 9 people in a branch on average in terms of the field staff we have. The financial position of the company, it has been top of mind, and it will continue to be top of mind, and we are rather proud that we have been able to, made the decision to refinance ourselves before the acquisition of SFN. In other words, if we couldn't have sort of refinanced, we would not have done the deal, because we're buying a long-term asset and we want to have long-term financing against it. And with the help of some of you, we have been able to arrange that early July. And it's clear that times were a little better at that time than they were today. But this is where you see the leverage ratio of Randstad developing. And the ambition is to have it below 2. With the banks, we have an arrangement to go up to 3.5, and between 2 and 3.5 is the buffer we have to be able to make to deal with a downturn. So it says strategic target here, but I should point out that if we get below, we will not necessarily leverage the balance sheet to get up to 2.0 times EBITDA again. It's a function of growth. If we can grow through acquisitions, we'll use the balance sheet. If not, we'll just let the cash flow in, and we might even have cash in the balance sheet for a while, but we will not be in a position to buy back shares. So we believe, again, as you can see here, that the development is correct at the end of the year, and we made that clear. We expect the leverage ratio of Randstad to be below 2.0 times EBITDA at the end of this year. This is looking back at the EBITA margin on slide 27, the blue line, and we have adjusted it for some what we believe unnecessary losses in the past. But as you can see, for sure the 4% should be achievable, and with the right ambition being north of 4, hitting the 5 or even more, and it does not include the synergies from the video transaction over here, we should be able to do better. But then we need the regular recovery patterns to continue. I have a few other topics, just briefly, and one is, if you don't plan, how do you kind of calculate the value of acquisitions? Because we don't have a clear vision on what we expect 2012 and 13 and 14 to bring. I have a few comments on that. But, you know, the key criteria when we look at an acquisition, I'm not going to go in detail because it repeats what we have shared before, but it should strengthen the strategic position of the company on slide 29. It should provide significant value creation, and it should fit us. We should be able to manage it. For example, in the U.S., we have a very strong base in terms of our management team. You'll see 2 more colleagues tomorrow, and on that it should build. But then when you get to the valuation, you know, this is a lot of art rather than science, but we're trying to put it into some clear baskets. So we look at the fundamental value, and then we look at price. We clearly make a distinction between that. We've all learned that at university, and we're still applying that at Randstad. And if you look at value, we look at DCF valuations and EVA analysis. So we look at details, for example, at the P&L per division. We look at the forecasts there are, including a full economic cycle. So we don't sort of do hockey sticks. We also include what we have seen in the past and terminal value. We have a relatively conservative approach. Then we do scenario analysis. Because we don't know, we just plot a couple of scenarios. For example, for SFN, we also plotted the 2008 scenario. And then we do also include all the synergies. And our assessment with the SFN deal is that even if we have a down scenario like in 2008, And if we include, so we surrender all the synergies, then still, economically, we do have a good deal. And that's how we look at it. In order to decide on price, we for sure look at the market analysis, the multiples, the historical transactions, and so forth. We look at it from the selling shareholder point of view and from the Randstad shareholder point of view. And then we plot all of that. And it meant, for example, that when we looked at SFN in April, we have been looking at SFN for years. It has been on our list, and it moved up when the profile of the company changed. It became more professional. And we have been sort of saying hello. So now and then, when we started to look at it a bit more thoroughly again earlier this year in the context of our ambition to expand our footprint in the U.S., to expand the footprint in professionals, and to expand the footprint in RMS, the stock price was 15 U.S. And I tell you, with these calculations, that became a very difficult one to justify premium, substantial premium. And then from there, the stock price started to slide. It sort of ended up at $9 in the month of July. With our synergies and these calculations, it justified us offering 14 U.S. for that company. So this is the background. The repayment schedule we'll have in May 2013. That's when the current syndicated loan facility expires. We have like just 1.4 billion of facility. We have arranged a forward start for 1.3 billion. So this move here is secured. There are more banks in here than here. There's 13 banks over here. This might be a little confrontational to say, but these are typically system banks, so the big ones, the ones that we believe that will continue. Who would have thought we would say things like that? But, you know, this is how we look at it, and we have to look at it. So 1.3 billion facility, and the cost is roughly 20 basis points higher than the old facility. We're very proud that we have been able to prepare for that. So the old facility will continue, and it will automatically be replaced by the new one in May 2013. Then my favorite topic, some regulations. And before going into this, maybe I should take it away for a while. I want to use the opportunity, because I'm not sure that you are aware that people think you need solutions as investors that we never discuss with you. So there is a diarrhea of regulations being created by politicians that cannot handle their own balance sheets, that think they should care for ours, which is quite remarkable. And one of these trends, and I'm just using the opportunity, is a guy that wants to be this president of France, Mr. Barnier, who comes up with regulations, for example, for auditors, external auditors. And he has just yesterday made a proposal, and this is a personal frustration, it's a Randstad frustration, but one of his ideas is that we will replace the auditor every 6 years by another firm. That means we're going to tell 40 countries in 6 years from now that they'll have to educate a completely new team of another audit firm about Randstad. That's going to cost us days, weeks. Whereas there are very nice sort of tools today. We have an audit committee, which is very independent, I tell you, a supervisory board, and they are in a great position to discuss the independence of the auditor. They can secure that. But I'm very frustrated. I mean, this is really an idiot proposal to think that changing the auditor firm every 6 years is going to add any value. It means a lot to us. It's going to create inefficiencies, and it also means we have an auditor that has no clue about the company. And it has been very difficult to subtract value out of an auditor over the last years, because it has been compliance as a first focus, the name of the game, instead of looking at the controls of the company. And, you know, this to us is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to the audit committee and to management that an outside party looks at the whole company every year, goes in, can open any file they want. We'd like to hear what they see. We'd like to hear the view of them about our management, about our closing process, about our shared service centers, about our IT projects. So I'm going to stop here, but, you know, if anyone ever asks you if this is a good idea, you should know we think it's a crazy idea. And this is what's happening because people in Brussels believe investors need it. There's also some other developments. It's called IFRS, which is, in principle, a great idea. to have some alignments. But there is one problem. There's 120 people sitting with Mr. Hogevorst in his unit in London, and these people can only do one thing, that is create new rules. So he's doing something wrong. He should send the 120 people home and then go to Randstad and to get the people he needs, instead of, you know, having 120 people that, by standard, produce new rules. And there is one area where they are thinking about new rules, which is in lease and rental contracts. I told you last year the proposal has been withdrawn, and they're now preparing for another one because they run into major difficulties. And the expectation is that in 2015 this will be effective, but we don't know the details by any means. But it is clear that the idea is that we'll replace rental expenses by interest and amortization. So EBITDA will go up, and there will be a shift down to rent to interest and amortization of fixed assets. And I don't know if it has an impact on the P&L. Last year I said I don't think so. And by then, actually, the whole thing was withdrawn, and they said it will only have an impact on the balance sheet, not on the P&L. They now are back to P&L again, but they have no clue how to do it. Effect in 2015, but, you know, there will be an increase in EBITDA and interest expenses and in net debt. That's the calculation, but it will last for some time. I think, you know, we would be well off if we just explain it in the notes rather than in the balance sheet and the P&L. And if you think so too, make sure he knows. And then we have some other changes in pensions and so forth, which have an immaterial impact on Randstad, because we basically have DC arrangements, or we have kept DB arrangements in the company. Even in the Netherlands, we have a clear collective defined contribution system, so Randstad will not be hit in any material way by any changes in this field. Finally, the dividend policy at Randstad. We continue to aim at a consistent dividend to kind of create a floor in the stock price. I have to say, so far we have not been as successful as we were aiming for, but we'll continue the policy with, again, €1.25 if earnings capacity and the financing policy, the balance sheet, allow for it. The payout ratio will be flexible. It will be not south of 30% and not north of 60%. So hopefully over time we'll see the €1.25 increasing. We didn't pay dividend in 08, 09. And I tell you, it still hurts. Because some of you know that I always give shares to my children, and I get a very, very serious discussion with them about dividend. And that was because our leverage ratio was north of 2. And that is why we are very much focused on keeping it below. So the rule is it below dividend? Is it north of it? Discussion. It's not like, you know, an automatic switch. And we clearly expect to pay out our dividends for 2011. And some of you are asking us for stock dividend. This is something we have on our list for discussion. And we'll continue to have a good look at it, and we'll learn from you whatever you think is necessary. But the first priority is to, again, pay dividend in 2012 on the profits of 2011. So that completes my contribution here. And now Ben and I are available for Q&A. Right, Jan-Pieter? Okay.
I have a question about the opening of the public sector in France. Is the potential stronger in in professional staffing than in general staffing, or in other terms, do you expect a better profitability in the public sector than in the private sector?
Your neighbor will answer.
A few answers. If you look at the development also of the labor force in France, you do see the services sector increase faster. So in general, we in the long term expect to grow much faster in services. Still, it's currently there's a big bulk in production, and that will probably remain for quite a few years. So this is a long-term picture. We don't expect the profitability in the public sector to be higher per se, because this if it becomes a volume business, it's going to be again bought in the way that government buys its services. So again, but you know our take on this, the gross margin will not be very high, but through efficient servicing, we do think it's an attractive sector with long missions and all the white collar business.
Hello. Could you remind us of what your policy would be in terms of stock buyback in case you have sufficient cash on the balance sheet?
Yeah, we have no such policy. So very clear. What we have said is that if the balance sheet gets inefficient, that's sort of part of the profile of Randstad. And given the growth opportunities in the market, we believe that that would help us to realize our strategy. The first priority is organic growth, but acquisitions are clearly part of our strategy. If we would have an extended period of time with cash in the balance sheet, we'll think about it once again and have a discussion with the supervisory board.
I was asking the question also in relation to the stock dividend option that you are considering. So in case you put in place a stock dividend option, would you consider buying back shares at the same time so that total shares outstanding remain constant or stable?
Yeah, it's under investigation. It is something we need to consider, so it's too early to give you a clear reply on this.
Yeah, David Rabo. Maybe on the public sector in the UK and Netherlands, do you expect another round of cuts for next year, or do we have seen most of it? And then maybe also on your margin scenarios, you're not mentioning a scenario of, let's say, more than a mild decline in sales. Does it mean you fully rule out this scenario, or let's say if there would be such a scenario, your margin target of 5-6% would be out of reach for at least a couple of years? Thanks.
I'll take the first part. What we see is that actually it's stabilizing. Of course, comparables get more easy, so I would not expect a second big dip in public sector spent with us. Yeah.
David, we don't rule out such a scenario again. It's the same toolkit that applies, and indeed, you're right, it will take a longer period of time, years, to get back to the targets. Yeah.
Morning, it's Jaime Branded from UBS. Just wondered if I could ask a couple of questions on MSP. Can you tell us, as of right now, if you include that $1.7 billion that you got from Spherion, how much total MSP expenditure you're now managing on a kind of last 12 months pro forma basis?
No, exactly. It'd probably be in the range of anything between $2.5 and $3 billion, is my guess.
And can you tell us how you're actually recognizing that in the P&L? So is that all being recognized on a net basis?
Yeah, we only recognize the margin we get. So let's say if you get 1.5% margin paid over that's what we would see in the P&L.
So what kind of number is that, just out of interest?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, well, let's say 1.5% of whatever.
That's minimal.
It's also not profitable. So on balance on EBITDA, it's more or less. Yeah, actually, this year we will have a slight loss. Next year, probably about break even is what my guess is. But it has no material impact on total business. What, of course, we do recognize, but that as normal revenue is if we supply to this client through the opcos, then of course it is all in the opco revenues.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question: is of that total,
how much
are you doing yourself?
I don't know the percentage. Sharp, do you know? 10% maybe in that range. Yeah.
It's limited currently, so it's 10%. So that's still a strategic challenge. That's why we have created this model to develop more aggressively into it. One more addition is the fact that you have all these classifications of companies in the MSP space, and we put in our in-house business in that respect because we do think in-house is the ultimate MSP because you handle everything on behalf of the client. And that's full revenue with 89.9% delivered through us.
Although I guess MSP implies, at least to some extent, that you're trying to be vendor neutral on behalf of the client.
No, we're not.
Is that not what MSP really is about?
Yeah, well, the rules of the game are neutral. So the MSP, of course, manages all suppliers on behalf of the client. But we're very vocal about the fact that we think the best supplier out there is us. So we are effectively two suppliers. We are the MSP provider with a neutral program, with KPIs, of course. But at the same time, we say we're going to help you into the real added value, and that's us as a dominant supplier. Still on a neutral basis, of course.
And as I talked about during the presentation, if we have to be strictly neutral, we're not interested. Because it's not a profitable model. It doesn't make any sense to have a lot of work, a lot of people tied into an activity that doesn't bring any return. So we don't like neutrality.
Thank you.
It's not in our character either, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, good morning. Laurent Brunel, Exxon BNP. Two questions, please. Looking at your different scenarios, you're talking about margin up with flat revenues. Will it come from a shift in the in the business mix with professional picking up versus industrial? Or is it a combination from, cost cutting? And you were talking about 20 million restructuring cost. And secondly, on the French market, what's your view in terms of top line development for 2012, given obviously less help from construction, easing...
What is the start of the question?
On the French market, your view on top line development, given the fact you focus on profitable contracts, so you may exit some contracts, and on top of that, the French construction market should decelerate next year, and I guess the early cyclical industrial segment will not help as well. Thanks.
Yeah, but the second part of the question is simple. It's field steering. So whatever we expect from an industry is irrelevant, which is good news for you. You were not there yesterday, I think. But yesterday we demonstrated how field steering works. So we manage on axles, we look at axles, and whatever the market does is nice to know. But market might go down, we might gain market share, so then we invest. Market might go up, we might have a lousy performance, then we have to save cost, etc. So the expectations in the market are being managed based on actuals, not on expectations. So that's for us simple, but also very efficient. It's the only way to capture all opportunities in the market. On the scenarios...
If we would, by the way, plan, we would always be wrong. That's why we're using the actuals. This is actually the answer to your question. So if we have a flat revenue development, it doesn't mean we're flat in each segment, in each country. It will be the mix that adds up to flat. And typically when it's flat, it means that industrial growth will slow down, clerical will be a larger contribution, professionals will be a larger contribution to the whole. And that by itself will help us to improve the EBITDA margin, but also the productivity improvements that we do see. That's what this is about. It's the portfolio, the cocktail of these elements that will drive the EBITDA margin up at flat revenue development. But again, the segments will change. The mix will change.
Tantelis, ABN. One question for me, and that's on your recovery ratio. Where do you regard the 50% recovery ratio most challenging right now? And what action do you take to achieve it anyway?
Yeah, I would say that across the board, we've been thinking about this. How does the current situation compare to 2008 as a starting point? And if you look at, for example, Germany, we have already sort of come back to the revenue level of 2008. The earnings are very solid. So across the board, we do have clear opportunities. In the UK, however, it will be more difficult. For example, that is a market where, taking out costs will be more difficult. In the Netherlands, it might be a bit more challenging, but I think across the board, we do have close to equal or even better opportunities than last downturn.
Yeah, the UK, the only, in addition to what Robert Jones had in the field, but in back office, we still have opportunity to save a considerable cost in the UK, by the way, but it's a small part of a small part, but anyhow, it will have an effect.
Matthew Lloyd at HSBC. Two questions. One, do you have any contingency planning for the unspeakable events of if the euro breaks up, i.e. in terms of your debt? So if you found yourself with the theta and lira exposure but debt in euros, have you planned through what the implications might be? And secondly, the slowdown in it that we're seeing in Europe, is that you're seeing clients wanting to fill sorry, just not putting any more vacancies with you, not asking for more business, or is it that they're just stalling and dragging their feet at the moment?
Slow down in, what was the question?
Slow down in Europe.
Slow down in what?
In Europe.
Ah, okay.
So is it no more orders coming through, or orders just taking forever to fill?
No, that's the easy part. He'll do the other part. There's no big shift in fill rates. That's what we look at. So that's what you mean. So the less business means less orders. And only in a few parts of the market, very specific. Again, we gave the example very often. Actually, last month, even unemployment in Germany still went down. Areas in Germany where unemployment is very, very low, especially for specific skills. That's, of course, where it gets more difficult to fill orders. But still, if you look at the fill ratios, there's no major shift there. So let's say the funnel, as you have practiced yesterday, is still more or less the same everywhere.
Thank
you. Does that answer the question? Yeah?
Sort of. And with regards to your euro contingency planning, we've indeed started this. It's weird. Huh? For example, we have our internal bank in Brussels and in Zurich, and from there we finance especially in euros. What to do about that? Will it be the German mark and so forth? So we've started looking at that and preparing for it. With regards to your question, you know, if we would not have the euro anymore and we would get sort of paid back in Greek drachmen and in Italian liras, etc., we're still sort of looking at those scenarios, but please note that the majority of our business is in countries where we believe, you know, the euro or something similar, if something happens, will continue, like Germany, like France, like Belgium. So we're working on it. And we haven't dealt with it completely. We were, for example, also, as I said, looking at the selection of banks. And that's what has translated into the selection in July.
Does the refinancing agreement allow you to switch currency? So the normal terms are about you need 90% approval from the banks or all of the banks if it's a revolver to agree a currency change, if I understand the law correctly. Did you write those clauses in or... that you could change the currency if required?
We did not.
No one.
Oh, here, there's a banker providing you with an answer. No one has. So we would be the exception.
We are investigating maybe change the base currency of the loan.
Sorry.
We are investigating to maybe change the base currency of the loan to US dollar.
In such a situation.
Let's say on a flat revenue scenario where you expect EBIT margins to improve next year, does that mean that you will turn the corner in the Netherlands on a flat revenue base and that you've moved away structurally from government exposure and you fix the underperformance in the Netherlands? Is that sort of in that base scenario on a flat basis?
Yeah, I think so. And the contribution of the Netherlands will be slightly bigger than it was last year because of, you know, the relative growth rates. But it will not count on a recovery of the public sector, by no means.
But again, it's a mix. We're a global company. We have exposure to many countries, many segments. The U.S. is booming, for example. So if total is flat, might still mean that other countries will do better than this year. So to take out one country as an example, it might be part of the scenario. Might also be that other areas of the company, that's the advantage of being everywhere, actually do a lot better than today, whereas Netherlands might be flat or whatever, so that's all part of the mix.
Okay, and is the bulk of the 20 million charge you're taking in the fourth quarter mainly in the Netherlands for government exposure?
It's a relevant part is in the Netherlands, but not only.
No, but the biggest part is, yeah.
Okay.
Not necessarily related to only government, it's mainly streamlining the organization.
Yeah, Wim Gillen, RBS. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about unit steering and how you manage your operating expenses, but the big unknown variable is obviously the gross margin. And do you have a bit of feeling on what kind of the underlying gross margin, excluding the mix effects because professionals are doing better, but the underlying gross margins, how these are going to develop in the foreseeable future?
What we expect the gross margins to, what's going on?
How you expect the gross margin to develop in the coming quarters in terms of price pressure, etc.
We are in a market. That means we'll see the same pattern we've always seen. So the margin will be driven by volume. So next to mix, but per segment. It's obvious that that margin will be driven by volume. The only difference with, of course, before the crisis is that already now we're still at a lower margin level. So that means the decrease you might have because of a decrease in volume, and by the way, always with a delay, is going to be smaller because more companies are going to feel pain earlier. When they were still very profitable, it was fairly easy to give in on lower margins. Today, of course, it's more difficult because quite a few countries make considerably less profit, so they have less room to maneuver. So in that respect, I would expect, but it all depends on the scenario. If the world collapses, of course, nobody knows. But in a let's say, controlled decline, more or less, if that exists, I would expect the decline to be less than what we've seen before in a similar decline. But it all depends on what's happening with volume, inevitably.
Can you give us an indication what the gross margin decline was, the underlying gross margin decline was in previous cycles?
Yeah, you can see it. We lost, 2.5-3% on average. But again, this is all, it's a very difficult comparison because it's all on the averages between the mix. So the geographies have changed, the segments have changed, and then we have seen different growth rates. As you've seen, in-house has been growing considerably higher than other markets. And what we always see is volume goes down, margin goes down with a delay, volume picks up, margin goes up with a delay, and very often doesn't reach the former highest point anymore. So you see a slow decline, which makes sense, of course. That's why delivery models also become more and more efficient, IT-driven and process-driven, obviously.
And we are curious to see the impact of less financing available in the market for mid-sized and smaller players.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the capital arrangements, the capital requirements for banks will be adjusted. And we have seen a lot of aggressive smaller and mid-sized players. And I guess that if they want to obtain financing, they have to show solid cash flows. So that might well have some positive impact.
Maybe the last question, please.
Mark Rotsenberg, ING. Quick question on your downturn scenarios. You undoubtedly have run through some recession scenarios, particularly for Europe. Could you give us an indication in what kind of scenario, in terms of top line, you could still maintain the margin of 2011?
No. No, we can't, Mark, but there's so many assumptions behind it that it would be a theoretical answer based on many, many assumptions. So that means the value is very low. So with all respect for the question, there's no way we can give a sensible answer that would have a real meaning, not getting into all the assumptions behind what the scenario would be.
Yeah, I'm not talking about all the assumptions, but just give us a sort of range what kind of declines you could cope with and still maintain margins. Given
the range is less relevant than the speed. If you see a gradual decline, as we've seen before, we are very confident that we can maintain very reasonable margins. So that's why we don't see a big threat. Of course, if you see a sudden a big drop, as we've seen with the last decline, that of course makes it far more difficult because you have to react a lot faster. So it's not so much the total decline, of course. If it's 30 or 40%, that's very difficult, but let's say. But it's more the speed at which it declines. That, I think, is more important than the actual decline.
But if revenues are flat, then we told you we believe the EBITDA margin should go up slightly.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe a short follow-up on this one. Looking to the gross margin, because that has never really recovered over the last 2 years, would you say that even if Europe goes into recession, that the gross margin would be relatively stable? Because
that's what I just said. I think that the room to maneuver for many companies is less. That means downside risk is smaller than it was before. But if volume really drops, it's going to happen a bit more for sure. But less so than I think in former, because it hasn't recovered yet, exactly as you said. Thank you.
Okay, we do a short break, 15 minutes for coffee and a biological break. So if you can please come back at 11:05, then we'll continue with the US. Thank you.